This is Regionally Speaking on Lakeshore Public Radio. I'm Chris Nolte. We're going to begin with an update. IndyStar.com is reporting this morning that Indiana now has 24 cases of the coronavirus. That's an increase of 5 cases over Sunday, and that's according to the Indiana State Department of Health. They've done 139 tests of people for the illness, and according to the testing criteria, all of them had displayed symptoms of the disease as well as exposure to somebody who had a confirmed case or was severely ill with a respiratory disease of some type. And most of the cases, they note, lately certainly have come from Marion County. They lead with 7 across the state. One of them is a new reported case, and the other in central Indiana is also Hendricks County. They've reported cases down there. We have only one case that's been reported here in northwest Indiana so far, and that's confirmed. That's in LaPorte County. Well, how are small businesses dealing with the coronavirus outbreak? Well, let's talk now with a lady who has had a chance to talk with fellow business people across the state. Barbara Quant is the state director of the Indiana Department of the National Federation of Independent Business, and she's joining us from her office in Indianapolis. Barbara, thank you for joining us on the program today.
Oh, thank you, Chris, for having me. It's an interesting time right now.
You had a chance to talk with small business people all across the Hoosier State, I guess, in a webinar on Friday. Tell us a little bit more about how that was organized and what all the members who participated talked about.
Well, this was not a webinar where folks were actually participating in it. It was one that provided a lot of information that would be a good resource for small businesses. Mm-hmm. We did do a survey last week, which now may seem like light years ago. It was taken on March 10th and 11th last week. And so the results that I'm going to talk about here reflect that snapshot, if you will. Just to give you a little background, NFIB has been representing small businesses for 75 years, and we have a research department that does, it's a foundation that does small economic trends report every month. And so we've been doing this for many decades, and so normally we do it every month. We're now going to be doing it every week during this, as I understand it, during this coronavirus outbreak. And so I can tell you what our snapshot said from last week. The survey found that while most small businesses are not currently impacted, owners are concerned about future disruptions if the outbreak continues to escalate. The vast majority of small businesses are not currently impacted by the coronavirus outbreak. However, the outbreak is negatively impacting about 23% of business owners.
Mm-hmm.
Now, if you're one of the small businesses that just heard that the governor is closing, as I understand it, I just saw that come over, is going to be ordering the closing of all restaurants and bars in the state of Indiana, that, that obviously that picture is going to be changing. Of those businesses that are negatively impacted, 39% are experiencing supply chain disruptions, 42% slower sales, and 4% sick employees. This is extremely fluid, and we should have another report out by this weekend, by Friday. I should be able to update you on this, but I expect that this will be changing.
Mm-hmm. In the meantime, what have small business owners across the state, ones you've talked to and ones that came up in the survey, the snapshot that you say was from this past week, what steps have they been taking to try to prepare their business from the outbreak itself?
Well, a lot of them are taking measurable steps to prepare, and 30% of the owners have stocked up on disinfectant and hand sanitizer for their business, if they can find it right now.
Mm-hmm.
And 12% have talked with employees about sick leave or work-from-home policies. 3% have modified their supply chain or changed their buyers or vendors. Now, this is part of the advice that's being if you have a supply chain, you should be checking with those vendors. Just over half have not felt the immediate need to take any measurable steps.
Has it been the case? Do you think that that they have a solid supply chain and they're able, or they've talked with them maybe just quickly to find out if there's any major changes coming up that they if that's how they feel at least for now things will be okay?
Yeah, I think they're feeling that they have a solid. Those that responded that way have feel that they have a solid chain. You know, this the level of concern is rising, as you can imagine. In fact, I just got off the phone with Jason Smith, who has M&M Car Care Center in Merrillville there. And he was calling because he wants to know what's happening with the SBA. And at this point, we don't have anything definitive from them. But he says his business is completely dead and that appointments are canceled. And so he's apparently, you know, this is usually a big time, big month for them as people get ready to go on trips and so forth. So he's seeing a tremendous impact. There, it depends on the kind of business you're in. I guess if you're a small business owner with in the restaurant or bar business, you're going to see it, you know, a tremendous change.
And it looks, too, that I guess if you're in a business where that you are able to work out your supply chain issues ahead of time, that will be to their benefit, to be sure. And I imagine even supermarkets and variety stores, especially stores that carry food items of some type or another, are finding the biggest effect right now.
Yes, and it, you know, this is changing by the minute. And for me, this feels kind of personal because I was I'm a former small business owner for over 20 years, and I can only imagine what's happening to them right now. You know, but small business is really on the front lines of this crisis, and let's think of ways we can help to support our local small businesses because they are going to be going through a very rough period of time, just like most folks.
I would imagine, you know, as you say, the restaurants and bars, especially the small neighborhood businesses, are going to be hurt the worst. Even if they're not in a chain necessarily, but if they're in just a small group, maybe like an owner that has maybe only one or two restaurants or taverns or the like to take care of.
Yeah, and those guys are going to be the worst hit. I would suggest you could order online and pick up at the curb or I know that Uber Eats is saying they'll deliver and so you can still go to your favorite restaurants but just not eat in. And so just think of ways you can continue to support your local businesses, you know, to order supplies locally rather than going right online, because they need to keep their doors open too.
I know it's hard to be able to plan for something like this ahead of time, but since all this, I guess, started overseas, that's probably been our inkling that something was going to happen in the United States and in Indiana to begin with. Have businesses been able to kind of plot something out, maybe say, well, let's talk about doing this as a way to deal with this in case it happens? And in the case of restaurants in particular, we know in Illinois that's certainly the case, that a lot of them are going to be going to take out and delivery from the curb and the like. To be able to deal with this, to stay in business, to keep people working. That's the important thing, I would imagine.
Yes, exactly. And think of ways that you can support the small businesses in your community because they're the ones that support you and your community.
You mentioned that you're going to have more snapshots as the more surveys are going out here every week to find out more. And the NFIB Research Center will have that information available for somebody that wants to look online.
Yeah, if they want to go online, they should go to. Let me give you the. This would give. Oh, it's www.nfib.com and then /webinars/ COVID-19/. Mm-hmm. So if you get to nfib.com/webinars, that should lead you to COVID-19.
You mentioned in particular one Northwest Indiana business is going to be negatively impacted by all this. Have you had a chance in the meantime to talk with any other small business people around, if not necessarily our region, but around the state? And have they come up with
In fact, we've asked folks to let us know, and they're, it depends on the kind of business that they're in.
Yeah.
Most were not feeling a great impact yet, but they were nervous because of what would happen in the future. So they are concerned. The level of concern about the virus impacting their businesses varies greatly in these initial weeks of the outbreak. But 44% of small business owners are somewhat or very concerned about potential impact on their business, and 28% and 16% respectively are somewhat concerned. So I expect these numbers will change, but not everybody is going to be. Some will see an increase in business. Yeah. Depends on what you're doing.
Well, I was going to ask if we've had any examples. It's too early to tell exactly how many, but some companies that have decided they're going to take some proactive steps and be able to come up with some innovative ways to be able to deal with this.
You know, this is one of the things I guess I would want to leave folks with, that this is not will not be the end of the world, that we will get through this. And as a former small business owner myself, and I've known so many for so many years, that there are the most industrious, inventive. I mean, these are the guys who risk it all to go into business, you know, mortgage the house, whatever. But they always can see a way to make through things. So these folks will be able to change the way they do business, most likely, and do what they can to still keep going through this. And we will get to the end of this, and it will be good once we do.
Well, Barbara, thank you for spending time with us talking about not only the things that are discussed and offered up in the webinar, but also the latest, one of many probably to come, of surveys out of the NFIB Research Center. And I hope to be back with you and have more good news to talk later. Thank you very much.
Okay, thank you, Chris.
Barbara Quandt is the state director in Indiana of the National Federation of Independent Business. Churches are taking steps to prevent the spreading of COVID-19 during worship, and some even canceling services altogether. But Indiana Public Broadcasting's Caroline Caruso tells us about one church in South Bend that held Mass over the weekend despite the outbreak.
Mass is starting at St. Matthew's Cathedral, but the church isn't as full as most Sunday mornings. Still, those who did attend have to adjust to some changes meant to protect churchgoers from the novel coronavirus. Holy water fonts were drained completely, and the sign of peace was given with waving and bowing instead of handshaking. All Bibles and hymn books were removed from the pews. That wasn't a problem for people like Jack and Renee Gordon, who bring their own books to church.
I go to Mass every day. It's like breathing to me. It's part of my inner soul. It's how I live.
They're aware of the health risks that come with contracting COVID-19, especially to elders like themselves. But Renee says now is the time she turns to religion more than ever.
We believe in the church. We believe that churches shouldn't be closed, that this is where people should come.
The Gordons say they plan to continue attending church, as they always have, even though Fort Wayne South Bend Bishop Kevin Rhodes lifted the obligation for Catholics to attend Mass through the rest of March. Brian McMichael is the director of the Office of Worship from the diocese.
For Catholics, Sunday Mass is a pretty big deal. We're all obligated to attend Mass at our parishes and keep the Lord's Day holy.
McMichael says the diocese did what it thought was best in the face of COVID-19.
Dispensing from that obligation was not a decision made lightly, but in this case, the concern for public safety, and especially for the vulnerability of our elderly parishioners, took priority.
St. Matthew's Cathedral followed other guidelines released by the diocese. The congregation practiced social distancing by spacing out around the chapel and staggering pews. Instead of passing around a collection basket, ushers came through with baskets that had handles. They've also limited music to the Saturday evening and Sunday 11 a.m. service, since they need to print out single-use hymn sheets. Receiving communion on the tongue is still an option, but it's strongly discouraged. Father Terry Fisher says he's never seen the church take such great measures.
This is really pretty radical for us, you know, to really change so much. But the health of the people is most important, so we'll do what we have to do.
Fisher was the priest for the Saturday evening service and some of the Sunday morning services. He says late Saturday and early Sunday were a normal-sized crowd, but the 9 and 11 o'clock were significantly smaller. Fisher says no matter how many or few people show up, he's happy they can hold Mass at all.
And like I said at the last Mass, we're very lucky there are places that don't have Mass at all on the weekends now.
But he says there's no pressure to make it to church these next few weeks.
If you are older, if you have a pre-existing condition, please stay home. You know, God understands.
Fisher recommends some alternatives to attending, like watching Mass on television, online, or praying at home. For Indiana Public Broadcasting, I'm Anna Caroline Caruso.
It won't be many more months before the Klein Avenue Bridge in East Chicago is open to traffic. Terry Villigan and Laura Wepper with Klein Avenue Bridge LLC were with us on Regionally Speaking to give us an update on the bridge's construction and the anticipated opening of the toll bridge to traffic this summer.
The bridge progress is going really well. We're actually, in terms of construction, about halfway with construction and erection of the segments. Anybody's been out to the site, we're to the canal, which is the Indiana Harbor Shipping Canal, and we just made it over what we call the east side, and we have erection crews out there on the east side putting up the segment. Mm-hmm. So part of the uniqueness of this project is actually the segments themselves. We have a box girder construction that we precasted 685 segments in a building that we built specifically to make the segment, so we could make those year-round. We completed that last year, and we have 685 segments to go up, and we're well on our way to complete this project with the erection. So part of that also is that we're simultaneously putting in the tolling system and also the lighting and cameras for the bridge. So we have a lot of other things going on just besides the erection, but everything is moving along really well.
Now, you talk about these additional systems that are going up, as well as are the segments to get the bridge moving toward completion. We've talked, of course, about the light. Obviously, the lighting is something important. What are the cameras going to be able to do when they're all up and running?
So we have cameras all along our bridge, which starts, if anybody's familiar with SR-912, which we call Klein Avenue. It starts as soon as you go north on Klein Avenue and enter into East Chicago. We have cameras up on the lighting poles, so we could monitor any slowdowns, any accidents, or emergency response teams. So it's valuable to us to help ensure that anybody who's traveling on the bridge has a safe and efficient passage over the canal.
We had our earlier conversation. You spoke at length about the work that was involved in getting the plan together, because obviously that you folks wanted to have a design that was not only a sound one, to be sure, but also it seemed to be rather unique. Is this bridge that is going up over Klein Avenue, over the canal in East Chicago, unique in its own right, or is it like maybe some others that might be similar in design?
This bridge design has been used for many years. We just perfected the construction, and we're always looking for better ways and more efficient ways to construct. So we've taken technology a next step in terms of quality control. Our primary goal is obviously safe and quality with our bridge. Part of it is with that box girder, we're able to make a structure that is more sturdy and sound and easier to construct. Now, one of the unique things about this bridge also is that from the east and west, you could actually walk all the way through the bridge on the inside, which allows us to look for other companies or collaboration to put utilities inside the bridge, much like fiber optic or water or electric. So we're in the process of looking for customers that need fiber optic that we could actually put through the bridge where it's not exposed to the element.
Mm-hmm. I bet you that's probably the biggest advantage, that you've got it completely enclosed, and you can take mm-hmm. advantage of that complete enclosure to help put in more services, and that's certainly the
correct
one too. So what kind of comments, I know recently, let's turn now to Laura, because I think that you were the one working the closest on the recent Cocoa with Klein informational session that was held last week at the East Chicago Public Library. What kind of information did you gather together from what you and Terry have worked on all this time to be able to present the folks that showed up for the event and explain to them how this is really going to affect the community of East Chicago and all of Northwest Indiana?
That's a great question. Thank you. So the primary thing we wanted to do is just provide clarity on the entrances and exits, how it'll work, how the tolls will be collected, create awareness, and provide a forum for any questions to be asked. And one of the other main things that we did was just provide some insight on how it's being built. So there's a few aspects we talk about when we do these kind of events. There's the construction aspect and the operation. So the construction is neat in and of its own right because it provides people a chance to see behind the scenes of a project that's really huge in scale. It's a mile-long brand-new construction. It's 100 feet tall at its highest. So it's for all ages, it's really cool for people to learn just exactly what it takes, whether you're a student considering going into the engineering field or if you're just a citizen wondering about what's this new thing in our backyard? What's it gonna, how's it made and how's it gonna work? So there's a construction aspect and then there's the operational part too. People wanna know, since it's a whole new bridge, how are they gonna get to it? How does it work? How does tolling work? So, and some people who haven't been in this area for a long time too, we're seeing that not everybody knows where this project is. So it's really fun to see when that aha moment happens, when we say, okay, you can get from South Lake County to Chicago in practically the blink of an eye, and they realize that finally there's going to be an alternative to the Borman in 1894. It's like, wait a minute, I can bypass that? So people from a lot of diverse perspectives coming and getting something out of it. So that's our goal, is to deliver information and provide a chance for people to ask questions because there's a lot of curiosity and people want to know how it's going to affect them. So the series that we're just starting has been really helpful with that so far.
How many more of these, maybe not necessarily Cocoa, but certainly a chance to meet with the Klein Avenue folks, Klein Avenue Bridge folks to talk about. How many more of these are you planning?
I'm still working on lining up more of these events. So we're looking at partnering with local libraries in Lake County.
Once again, crews are anticipating the completion of the Klein Avenue Bridge and opening up to traffic as a toll bridge this coming summer. As far as the COVID-19 virus is concerned, the illness, we should say, that is created by the coronavirus is concerned, Governor Holcomb spent some time last week. He'll have updates today, and we will bring those to you as well. As far as recommendations to help prevent the spread of the new virus, encouraging people to work from home and making it easier for schools to be able to close, which the schools here in the public schools, at least in Lake and Porter and LaPorte counties, have decided already to do. Indiana Public Broadcasting's Darian Benson tells us about medical professionals who are urging people to take the precautions very seriously.
By taking small steps now, the governor says we can slow the spread of the virus and avoid overwhelming the healthcare system with a wave of sick people. Dr. Romero Yaletti is the chief physician executive of Community Health Network, says the state's precautions help limit contact with other people. He says that kind of social distance is important, even if you're not part of a high-risk group.
So the reason we're telling everybody to be cautious is that it's highly contagious. And even if it's not going to change your life, it can impact somebody else simply because unintentionally you infected somebody who's at a high risk.
Galletti says people with lung disease, heart disease, and other health conditions should avoid going out in public. He says if exposed to the virus and not part of a high-risk group, most healthy people's immune systems will fight off the illness. For Indiana Public Broadcasting, I'm Darian Benson.
Governor Holcomb signed an executive order on Friday that's meant to help get groceries and medical supplies to Hoosiers during this outbreak. And Justin Hicks tells us more about this order that is lifting restrictions on the number of hours that commercial truckers can drive.
Truck drivers can usually work up to 14 hours a day with a mandatory 10-hour rest. Now they can complete a delivery of food, consumer goods, and emergency supplies no matter how long it takes. The governor's executive order mirrors a move by the federal government to lift regulations. Tim Wingate is a driver for Schneider Trucking. He says it's good for the supply chain, but he worries less experienced drivers might get tired and fall asleep on the road.
It's a good thing because, you know, we can get medicine to people quicker, and it could be a bad thing because not knowing who's taking it, it could be a guy fresh out of school, or it could be somebody like me, it's 11 years, or somebody's got more experience.
The federal government's ease of regulations is in effect until midnight April 12th, but the states will last until April 5th. For Indiana Public Broadcasting, I'm Justin Hicks.
This is Regionally Speaking on Lakeshore Public Radio. I'm Chris Nolte, and we will be checking in with our lawmakers here in Northwest Indiana to see how the 2020 General Assembly session went. Let's check in first with State Representative Chris Chung, who's a Democrat from Dyer. And Chris, thanks for joining us on the program today.
Thank you for having me, Chris.
Well, you had a busy session this time. A number of measures that you had introduced as well as got the chance to join on with other lawmakers on that have an impact here on Northwest Indiana, in particular in Lake County. And I know one of them that we'd like to find out more about is the latest about the measure that would in turn get the community of Griffith annexed from Calumet Township, which has been ongoing for quite some time, but it's getting closer and closer, it looks like.
That's right. It's been 7 years that this saga has been playing out, I've learned, and I've only been here for the last two. So the legislation that we passed this session, ultimately after Griffith was unable to successfully appeal to North and St. John Townships, and then they tried to go to Ross, who said no as well, then we decided as a body that we would have them join with North. From the beginning, I kind of thought North was the most similar fit to Griffith. Just, you know, Highlands in there and they're similar towns. I thought it was kind of a stretch to put them into St. John Township. But at any rate, what the legislation passed allows them to do is to leave Calumet Township without having to appeal to any more of the township boards. And it was a fraught decision, for sure. It was. I think I was one of the few Democrats who actually voted for the legislation, if any. And, I hear the arguments from my colleagues that the process wasn't great. I mean, it was introduced as an amendment in committee. We didn't have a lot of time to hear from a lot of the stakeholder folks. But ultimately, in the end, I'm standing with the 98% of constituents I have who did vote to leave. So that was probably, one of our most consequential pieces of legislation mm-hmm. that we did end up bringing home this session.
Now, as we talk here on Monday, how do things stand with that measure? Is it gone all the way through and it's now headed for the governor?
That's correct. It is.
What likelihood, I guess maybe if he has any objections to the idea, or have you gotten any kind of clue from the governor's office whether he's going to sign off on this?
We're quite sure. I mean, the governor has not made any indications that he wouldn't right now, as he is kind of preoccupied with quite a lot of the other things going around in the state. But we didn't have any indication, our legislative leaders, that he wouldn't sign it. So it's basically a done deal.
Okay. Now, what's the mechanism now for this? If the governor signs the measure and it becomes law this summer, that means that the mechanism gets underway for a North Township to take in Griffith?
Correct. And I believe the actual language in the bill, let me just pull it up, I'm on my computer, is mm-hmm. that by the beginning of 2022, if no decision has been made, then the town will automatically be transferred into the nearest neighboring township with the highest assessed value, which would be North Township.
Right.
So, yeah.
All right. One of the other measures I know that you sponsored and introduced this session had to do with helping, I guess, get a way to find some taxpayer-funded handouts that go to corporations changed here. How did that measure turn out this session? And tell us more about it, please.
So, unfortunately, that amendment I introduced failed along party lines, as you can imagine. But basically, my argument for it was that right now, taxpayer dollars through the Indiana Economic Development Corporation, which does great work, by the way, but we don't argue that, we think that there should just be a little more transparency in the process. When companies like Amazon come in, and it was in 2017, they were shopping around their big HQ2 second headquarters, and a lot of governments, state governments, city governments, municipalities, all offered a lot of money to this company. And it's the, you know, one of the biggest companies on earth, led by the richest man on earth. And I'm just thinking, you know, where is the logic here in offering billions of dollars in tax-free funding to the richest person on earth when the average guy on the street, you know, needs tax relief more than anyone else? So what I wanted to do, my amendment formally would have forced the IEDC to make public any application and any dollar amount that was offered to a corporation looking to move to Indiana, like Amazon was looking to at the time, 3 years after that application has been made. So from beginning to end, the Amazon process took only 14 months, and that was a nationwide hunt. So you can imagine 3 years is pretty generous. And right now, a different group is suing the state in order to get access to those documents. And I'm a big believer in taxpayer transparency, but ultimately it did fail along party lines, to my disappointment.
Mm-hmm. One other measure I know that you did join in on was for House Bill 1003, and has come up for discussion here, is going to have a big effect on, among other school districts, the Gary Community School Corporation, because it has a number of vacant buildings and properties that have gone up for sale. There have been bids put out on the properties, luckily, but it may have a chance here that charter schools could get their feet in the door on some of these. How does that measure stand? I know that you put up an amendment during the session on that.
Right, yeah, and we're happy about the new language that got placed into law regarding the Gary school repayment of their debt and making it a little more easy for them to pay it back in increments rather than big chunks at once. But yeah, ultimately, that's something that is also a distressing part of the law. A different bill that we passed, actually, where charter schools now can get access to public referendum money. So the school referendum that we're seeing all these corporations have to come back to the taxpayer hat in hand year after year, that may be accessible to charter schools in an area. And that, I think, is not good policy. I disagreed with it. I voted against it. And it's something that will definitely raise the price tag of school referenda, which I can tell you are not popular by any means, whether it's a Democrat or Republican or independent. Nobody likes, you know, having to hear that another referendum is coming up. But that's the unfortunate reality of the school funding formula that Indiana has put in place and makes it impossible to run a school corporation if you don't have these referenda. So that's a really distressing piece. I haven't seen a lot of news coverage about it. It was passed in the 11th hour. But I think it was House Bill 1065 was the ultimate one where that language got in, and I was very much opposed to that.
And that's headed on to the governor for his review on it as well?
That's correct, okay. Yeah. And again, we haven't gotten any indication he wouldn't sign it, so it looks like it's a done deal.
Okay. What are some of the other measures that you put up or you supported this time around that you know, aside from the town of Griffith annexation question, or secession question, I guess, and annexation into North Township question, has come up here and is headed off for the governor to take a look at?
Well, one bill I was pretty happy to co-author was with Representative Chris May. He brought legislation that would allow for local governments to enter into interlocal agreements, compacts basically, to set up land banks. And a land bank is used as a kind of entity that will allow for the rehabilitation of distressed properties. And there have been efforts over the past few years to start a land bank in Lake County, because God knows we definitely have a lot of distressed properties in the county. And what this would allow is for a streamlining of the tax sale process, the allowing of a little mechanism of funding to make sure that these properties go to people who are going to apply for them and care for them and have dedicated roots in the area, not just some, you know, investor who's out of state and is going to sit back while he lets the property decline. Not that kind of thing, but first-time home buyers, low-income folks who might need a little bit of assistance with their down payment and mortgage payments. That's what I was really excited to see. And in the next few years, I'm hoping that we'll see more action on those distressed properties here in Lake County.
Now, Chris, are there any measures that you have taken up that didn't make it this session that you're considering maybe reintroducing in the 2021 session?
Yeah, there are actually a few. I'm working on a spreadsheet as we speak now, as we're all holed up in self-quarantine, basically. I'm working on my spreadsheet for the 10 bills I want to introduce next year, and a number of them deal with financial institutions, because I sit on that committee regarding all banking and credit loans and all kinds of law that touches every loan that's made in Indiana. That's something that we're looking to get more bipartisan compromise on, because as of late we've seen not too much progress made on making this a great state for consumers to get access to cheap credit, and for folks to be able, especially our veterans folks actually, to be able to benefit from some lower priced interest rates. And we've been talking with the veterans community for a while now to get them that access, and I'm excited about the potential for next year for that legislation and a number of other things as well. Mm-hmm. So, yeah.
What's been your general assessment of how the 2020 session went?
Well, you know, we passed some things, but I really wish we made more action, quite honestly. Like on the healthcare front, for instance, we had a bill that passed out of the House that would have mandated more transparency on the industry. And ultimately, when the Senate gave it back to us and we had to vote for it on right before we sent it to the governor, it was really, really watered down and really disappointing. Surprise billing is something that affects a really narrow segment of Hoosiers. And basically what that is you go to an in-network hospital, but then an out-of-network radiologist or anesthesiologist or whoever comes and treats you, and then you get a $100,000 bill in the mail because you had no idea, you were not conscious, or you were not making decisions when you got that emergency care. And then when the surprise billing language came back to us, it exempted emergency services. And I just thought, that's so crazy. That's the time when you need surprise billing legislation the most, and somehow it came back to us with this, you know, watered down version that's not going to really help anybody. So I was pretty disappointed in the healthcare effort that was watered down at the end and ultimately not going to lower premiums or deductibles or co-pays for Hoosiers. And then the second thing I was really kind of dismayed about was the House also passed legislation clarifying what would happen in the case that the current Attorney General, Curtis Hill, who, as your listeners probably know, is in a really embattled state after multiple allegations of sexual assault, and the calls from the governor, Speaker of the House, President of the Senate, Senate Pro Tem, after calls from all of those folks from his own party to step down, he's refused. And we passed legislation that would have specified what would happen if his law license is suspended by the Supreme Court, which is currently pending in front of the state Supreme Court, and his eligibility to run for reelection. But the Senate killed that language. So right now, it's on the state Supreme Court to decide whether or not Curtis Hill will be eligible to run for reelection in this year, in 2020. So it's really a mess, and it's really not a good way to govern, and just shows how dysfunctional some of the players can be in the state of Indiana. And there's a lot of personal, you know, beefs going on behind the scenes that I think are childish. But, you know, we did pass good legislation out of the House, at least I can say, and then ultimately the Senate came back with things we didn't like.
Do you think that this next session, of course, being a budget writing session, the two-year state budget will have to come up for review in 2021. Do you think this will be a tougher session maybe ahead than maybe usual to be able to get some of these measures that didn't make it this time around back in?
Absolutely. Every budget year will be fraught with debate. I mean, we're talking about arguing over how to spend $35 billion. A lot of people get really heated when you bring up that discussion, especially I'm looking at with the mess we're in now with the coronavirus pandemic. I'm trying to look at the amount we're spending as a state on public health dollars. It's kind of absurd what's going on, that people can't get tested when there are symptoms going around. In fact, I myself am currently exhibiting flu-like symptoms, and I've been self-quarantining myself for the last 4 days or so. Mm-hmm. But the fact is that we aren't able to get tests out to people, and certain respirators, different masks, different medical supplies, that we don't want to have a shortage on the healthcare provider front. So public health funding has definitely coming up for a more fraught debate, especially with what we're dealing with today.
Well, Chris, take care of yourself, as I know you're trying to do, at least for self-quarantine method as a way to take care of it now. And we hope that maybe this issue does come up and have a chance to make it through all the other chatter that will come about in the 2021 session, and we'll try and deal with that as well, too. And thank you for spending some time going over this past session and some thoughts about what is lying ahead in the next year ahead. Thanks very much.
Thank you so much, Chris. You have a nice day.
Thank you. That's State Representative Chris Chung. He's a Democrat from Dyer. A woman in Crown Point is self-quarantined after testing negative for the flu, strep throat, and RSV. She's being tested for coronavirus today. And Lakeshore Public Radio's Tom Maloney talked with her this morning.
When did the self-quarantine begin, and why did you take that precaution?
My quarantine started Thursday of last week, and because I started with a sore throat, and then got a fever, and then got a dry cough and really bad headache. I called my doctor's office thinking I needed to be swabbed for the flu, but not sure what to do. And they advised that I self-quarantine.
So you had a Facebook post go, I guess, quasi-viral, a lot of shares on that. In it, you talk about being swabbed for seasonal flu, strep, and RSV. All of the tests came back negative. Can you talk me through the steps about you attempting to get a test for the coronavirus?
I can. It's kind of complicated and long. So when I was feeling really unwell, and because I had actually traveled through O'Hare and Tampa International in the 2 weeks prior to falling ill, I messaged my doctor through the MyChart app saying, you know, I traveled. Here's my symptoms. I'm not sure what I need to do or if I should be self-quarantining, and asking for his advice. They told me I should self-quarantine immediately and that they wanted to swab me for seasonal flu and the other things. and that they thought that I should probably be checked for coronavirus if those came back negative. He then had to call me back to say that Franciscan at the time didn't have the ability to test for coronavirus. However, they wanted me to come in before hours so I wouldn't expose anybody else, obviously, and swab me for the other things so we could at least rule those out, or hopefully one of them would come back positive so then we'd know what I was dealing with. I then got another call saying that they apologized. My doctor felt horrible, and so did his nurse, but Franciscan had said I couldn't come in at all. They weren't allowed to swab me. They didn't want anybody with flu-like symptoms in the office, and that if it got so bad that I had to have medical intervention, I needed to find an ER, and that was the only way I was going to see a doctor. So I said, okay, and they said, okay, so you need to self-quarantine for at least 2 weeks, and then we'll go from there. My good friend, Dr. Bryant, who is not normally my doctor, was kind of talking me through some things. And she said that she's like, we need to know what's going on with you, because if it's something treatable like strep, then we need to get you on antibiotics or you're not going to get better right away. And at least you'll know what you're dealing with. And so she said, come to my clinic, drive around back, stay in your car. I'll come outside. And she had on like the full protective gown, gloves, mask, the whole thing. And she's like, I'll just swab you while you stay in your car so we know. And so that's how I ended up finally getting swabbed for those things.
And again, those tests coming back negative. Jennifer, you're not alone at home with a quarantine, correct?
Correct. I have two kids and my husband.
How are they feeling?
Since we started quarantine, one of my daughters has started the dry cough. No fevers, doesn't seem like anything else. She's just coughing constantly. My other daughter has been complaining off and on of a sore throat. Again, nothing else, just a sore throat. And my husband so far is doing great.
So you've got somebody able to go ahead and run the household while you're resting.
He's been amazing.
How much longer then do you have in quarantine?
Because my kids started showing symptoms Saturday, it'd be 2 weeks from Saturday.
So you've got another couple of weeks ahead of you. You're getting tested, correct? For coronavirus, you've managed to...
I finally am. Because of all of the various regulations, neither one of the doctors in the area that I've seen were able to do so. But there is a doctor's office in Couts, Indiana, where she is actually going to test me. They're using a private lab, So I got on a list there, and I'm getting tested later today.
Jennifer, I want to thank you for your time talking with me about what you're going through, and let us know, hopefully, fingers crossed, that test comes back negative as well. But please keep
thank
us abreast of your status.
I will.
And Wilson should have her results back soon, and we will keep you updated. And we have Tom Maloney in the studio with us to talk about the conversation that he had with this lady in Crown Point. And in general, what you've learned as well, probably learned quite a bit, and even just talking with her briefly on the phone today.
Yeah, Chris, Jennifer's story is a lot like a lot of stories that we're hearing right now, not only across Northwest Indiana, but across the state and the country. Individuals who are feeling sick, who are not able to get in for testing, we're hearing lots of stories or reports, rather, even information coming from the president in Friday's press conference, talking about massive testing being done in Walmart parking lots, drive-through testing like they've been doing in the South Pacific, specifically in South Korea and Taiwan. But that is not yet the case here in Northwest Indiana or the rest of our state. Lots of individuals wondering where these test kits are that were promised by Vice President Mike Pence just a few weeks ago when he was charged with heading the coronavirus task force, I would call it. And he had promised something along the lines of about 4 million tests being available. That's not the case. And a lot of Hoosiers right now are wondering and worrying. Of course, breaking news out in the last hour that Governor Holcomb has decided to close all bars and restaurants to dine in. It's still open for carryout, as are our neighbors in Illinois as well as Ohio. Some folks might argue it's a little too late, unfortunately, for Indiana, but that it's being done now shows some steps forward in terms of trying to contain the virus.
Now, the governor has ahead of his news conference this afternoon, and we'll, of course, have more information from the folks with IPB News in Indianapolis later. The saving today on All Things Considered and for this evening, about this. But in the meantime, he's put out a statement talking about his plans to talk more about putting up, I guess, the stop of, I guess, to try to stop the spread of the virus by closing bars and restaurants and the like. In the statement, he said he was going to adhere to the Centers for Disease Control and Prevention's guidance to cancel or postpone in-person events of more than 50 people. And the governor also, in his statement that was out this morning, is also encouraging Hoosiers to donate blood. And in the meantime, we've gotten something from the from Indianapolis about the concern that there are about 1,330 units of blood that have been lost because of canceled blood donation appointments because of local blood drives across the Hoosier state that have had to cancel out because of the fact that they don't want groups to get together and be too many people in one group, even though they're donating blood for a very good cause.
So in real time last night, when we saw the CDC's recommendations that there are no groups larger than 50 getting together, I'm supposed to be attending a wedding next month, though I think a lot of people are probably attending weddings over the next few months, birthday parties, bridal showers, baby showers, etc. And I've talked with the bride and groom. They are looking at rescheduling a wedding. I know another couple who's also planning on rescheduling, not for later this year, but into next year as well. Of course, right now, we should be listening to John Cain's conversation with Jeff Brown on Eye on the Arts, but the 35th annual Valparaiso Jazz Fest has been canceled as well. So in the world of live radio, you need to fill a hole. Sometimes you call somebody else from down the hall to come in. So a lot of events, a lot of individuals are seeing these events being canceled or postponed. Definitely recommend following the CDC's guidelines and reaching out to event organizers, whether it's a couple, whether it's a family, whether it's a university or whatever it is, to find out if those events are still taking place. And a little maybe a little teaser as well for the audience. We're supposed to have debates on April 1st and 2nd for the vacated seat for Representative Pete Visklosky, and I'll be talking with the League of Women Voters later today to determine our next steps with regards to those debates?
Well, we know that Valparaiso University jazz professor and the creator of the Jazz Festival, Jeff Brown, was going to be noting the 35th anniversary of the Jazz Festival this year, mm-hmm. and was going to be around for next year's 36th. So it looks like it definitely will be the 35th, whichever date it comes up on, whether it's 2020
Certainly.
Or 2021, to be sure. Tom Maloney, thank you very much for spending time with the updates on this. We appreciate it, and our best of luck to the lady from Crown Point who's going in for the testing as well. Hopefully she comes up that she'll be negative for this, and maybe it's just a regular flu. We'll find out anyway. That's it for Regionally Speaking for today. I'm Chris Nolte. Thank you for joining us, and we'll be back with you tomorrow.